Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the AMAA, Martial Arts Masters, Blog Talk Radio Show, hosted by the American Martial Arts Alliance, dedicated to building the awareness of professionalism in the martial arts through martial arts management and student development.
Hello, everyone. This is Grandmaster Jesse Bowen, and welcome to another show of the AMAA, Martial Arts Masters. And tonight, we have two of the martial arts greats, and I'm very fortunate to have the opportunity to have called these guys my friends, my mentors. They've been a really big help in helping to guide me in my martial arts study. And really, this is the thing that we talk about, the martial arts, is finding mentors. You know, our show covers everything from the sport karate to this past week we had Dana Abbott on, the samurai, talking about his experience studying in Japan. And tonight we have two of the most outstanding people that I know. And I said again, mentors. If you don't have a mentor in the martial arts or in your business or in your personal life, then you're really on a road by yourself. The fastest way to the top is find those people that have a great understanding about what you're doing. You know, become a part of who they are. Find out what made them great. Observe them. Mimic what they do. We're always modeling people and things what they're doing. If you're a martial artist, and this is what the Who's Who's book is about those people who have done things, who have set the path for you to be able to model. Tonight we have Hunchy Larry Isaac and Hunchy Bill Hayes. Hey, guys, how you guys doing tonight?
Hey, doing great.
Very well.
That is so awesome. Yeah, sir, you're doing good up in Virginia. That is great, sir. So, guys, you know, yeah. I wanted to start the show off by, you know, just saying, personally saying thank you. I know, Mr. Hayes, you know, you have, we've known each other now for some years now, and I want to just say thank you for being an outstanding model as a martial artist, as a man. And truly do appreciate the experience and the friendship that we have shared. And, you know, Hunchy Isaac, you know, I'd just like to say, you know, of course, thank you. You've been there thousands and thousands of times for me, directing me on the right path that I should be on, providing me with the personal knowledge as a martial artist, and also the personal training that you have provided for me. I just want to say thank you. I wanted to get that off, you know, right away to say thank you, guys, and for calling or being on the call tonight. Now, I know that you, both of you guys have books out, and, you know, Auntie Isaac, I know you have a new book that just come out, and Mr. Hayes, I know that you have a book that you are rewriting. So before I get into all of that, what I'd like for you guys to introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about you, and we're going to, you know, I have some questions I wanted to ask you, but I thought we would start off by having you to introduce yourself. I know you guys in many of the traditional circles you're known, and in the sport karate circles that you're also known. And I was hoping, Mr. Hayes, that I just bought a book on a magazine online. I think it was 1970 something. It had a picture of you on the cover with a set of size. I saw it. I paid $17 for the book, for the magazine. So I'm sure hoping it arrives.
My goodness. Well, that must have been in the Smithsonian bookstore.
I was doing some research on you, and I actually came across on Amazon, someone was selling an official karate magazine that had your picture on there, and it said $17. I'm going, oh, my God. I said, I'm going to buy this I'm going to buy this magazine, but I'm definitely going to be telling you about it, that I really invested because I really want to have that in my collection there. So who would like to start first? We won't go with seniority here. Anyone who wants to start can start.
Well, Master Sergeant Isaac is senior to me on the karate side, so he can certainly go first.
Well, thank you, Major. I'm glad the Major threw me under the bus. With regards to that magazine that you have, Mr. Bowen, I happen to have that same magazine that I picked up some years ago. I'm not going to say how many years ago it was, but I picked it up really when it first came out. And I still haven't had Mr. Hayes sign it yet, but I'll get around to that. My name is Larry Isaac. I joined the Marine Corps in 1968. I retired in 1991 as a Master Sergeant of Marines. I did a tour in Vietnam, several tours in Okinawa where I trained with various instructors. My first Okinawan instructor was Shinobuku Yezo O-sensei in the Shobayashi-ryu. In fact, the same instructor that Mr. Hayes have, I'm a second generation with him. And some years later, I transcended over, well, I should say transferred over to Okinawa Kempo under Odo Sekichi, who passed away in 2002. And being without a instructor, or being a ronin, for lack of a better word, I started training with Nita Sensei, who advanced me to the rank of Judan, Kef Dan. All my instructors of whom I received advancement were Okinawan instructors, Okinawan grandmasters. The book that I recently completed and is now on Amazon, it's about a 20-year project. I started when I was in the Marine Corps, and I actually had completed it. And I let a few people read it, and everyone kept telling me, we don't want to know about karate history. We want to know about you and why you do what you do and how that has helped you in the martial arts and how that has became a very important part of your life. And so here we are today on the radio, and we're going to talk about that. So, Mr. Hayes, your turn.
Sure. Again, my name is
Bill
Hayes.
Well, before he starts, I'd like to say one thing before Mr. Hayes starts. That's the thing I really like about you, sir, is that you really study the martial arts. You're a historian. You have hundreds of books and. And, thank you for the copy that you sent. But this is the key element that I'm trying to get martial artists to sort of understand, is that if you don't have this information, your library is so important, because as you now begin to tell your story, it's a combination of who you are, your experiences, your knowledge. These are the things that really make us a martial artist. It's not about the number of trophies that you actually win. It's about the experiences we have and how we've used those experiences to change the lives of others and how these experiences have changed our lives. And I think this is really good. And this is where everyone, we've reached that point in our lives that we have a story. And our story is a very important story. It's designed to physically and emotionally and mentally be able to move and help someone else to be able to make to that next level is about the stories that that we tell. So, hey, sir, we got some really good things. I know that you're going to share with us tonight. Hey, Mr. Hayes, it's your turn.
Yes, sir. Well, born and raised in New York City, born in 1945. I joined the Marines at 1964, but I started martial arts training in 1960. My father was a semi-pro light heavyweight boxer, so he taught my brother and I to box. When we were very young, we fought for the Police Athletic League, 103rd Precinct in New York City. But even when I was winning my matches, I was still coming home with sore ribs, black eyes, and all of that. So I bumped into an exchange student, an Okinawan exchange student at Long Island University. I had no money. He needed to learn English, so he agreed to teach me some karate in exchange for me simply reading a newspaper to him so he could hear conversational English. And that's how I got my start. And again, 1964, I was off to join the Marines, and by 1966, I was on my way to Vietnam, and I stopped on Okinawa, as all Marines do, and spent some weeks there getting ready to go to Vietnam. And Shirabuka Sensei, his dojo was right across the street from the camp I was at, and I told myself if I made it out of Vietnam, that that would be the place I would like to study. And sure enough, 13 months later, there I was stationed on Okinawa. I joined his dojo after a couple of attempts to join his dojo. He allowed me to be a student of his and accepted me. I was a second-degree black belt when I walked into his school, but that didn't mean very much. And I've been with him as an instructor ever since I've left his organization. I've had 3.5 tours on Okinawa over various periods of time, 2 tours in Iwakuni, Japan. I had a second tour in Vietnam, and then spent 26 years total in the Marines, retiring in 1990. I was fortunate, like Larry, I came in as a private and we made it all the way up to Master Sergeant. I was even luckier and was picked for a commission in 1973 and was able to retire as a major in 1990. And that led to some interesting things. And I've been part and parcel of the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program from its initial days. That's something I have to say I take some pride in since it's Marine Corps-wide. But I enjoyed a phase of tournament competition during the late 60s and 70s. But the real pride is on my part, if I can say that, is having studied with an Okinawan who really was and is a true master of the martial arts. My sensei is 92 years old as we speak, and just still doing well. We're having some difficulties, but doing well on Okinawa. My book, My Journey with the Grand Master, the subtitle is Reflections of an American Martial Artist on Okinawa, was my stab at trying to convey what Okinawa was like in the 60s. It started as a series of notes for my students who might never go to Okinawa, for those who might go but not see the Okinawa that I was privileged to live through. So it talks about the history and culture of Okinawa, so we lay that foundation. My teacher, of course, is the focus of the book, and in the middle of the book, there's a knucklehead from America who joins my teacher's dojo. Of course, that's me. And I try to talk about the Okinawan people, their music, their food, their history, the suffering they went through. The last land, air, and sea battle of World War II was the Battle of Okinawa, and how that affected the island, even to this day. So that wraps it up. And, of course, we talked quite a bit about karate, the training on Okinawa, what it was like. And I did that not only, again, to lay something of a path for my students, but Okinawans tend not to write their own history, their own karate history. So I'm happy to hear that Mr. Isaac's book is out. I've got the 4 copies sitting upstairs now, plus a signed copy from him. So I'm happy to spread the word myself in a small way, and very happy to see his book out there, spreading the word in a big way.
Well, guys, you know, both of you have done a lot worldwide of influencing, you know, traditional martial arts, everything from the technique. I know Mr. Hayes to the health and wellness. So let's speak a moment about the health and wellness of martial arts. You know, we're always talking about the competitor. So what I want tonight to do is talk about the tradition of the martial arts and the things that the martial arts will do for us on the health side. Why don't you share a little bit about that?
Which one of us?
Let's talk about the health side. You know, the eating, the food, the habits, those things.
Well, which one of us would you like to respond?
Go ahead and respond. Then I'll pigtail off of you.
Okay.
Mr. Hayes.
In point of fact, as I mentioned earlier, my teacher is 92, and that is not uncommon for Okinawans. And it's not by accident. Their food, in fact, I was looking at some very old books on herbology, and one of the books that we asked folks to take a look at as they advance their art is the Budishi, the Book of Martial Virtue, which began in China. There's an Okinawan version of it. But in that book, the fine point of it is that there's a nexus between what we eat and how we perform. My teacher actually used to ask me before I came to before I would train on a particular evening, he would ask me what I ate that day. And that would help dictate the training. You'll hear three major phrases on Okinawa. One is Ishoku Ugen, which means eat well, be well. The other is Harahachibu, do not eat more than what will make you 80% full. The other is Muchi Gusui, which is a phrase in the old Okinawan language of Muchi no Gusui. And Muchi Gusui means food is medicine. And that's how they treat it. And this comes from the traditions from the Shaolin Monastery in China. If you were a graduate monk from the Shaolin Monastery, of course, there was no doc in the box to go to if you came down with an illness, or let's say you had an encounter and some of your vital points were struck and some of your organs became somewhat dysfunctional. You had to be able to cure yourself, and much of that was through herbal medicine, and also how you trained. Even our stretching, what we call Junbi Undo, preparatory exercise, is designed to open up energy channels in the body. And we see folks using techniques and training for certain techniques in such a way that they actually damage the body. And I think we all know of folks who retire early, let's say in their 30s. And on Okinawa, there is no such word for retirement. That's in society generally and in the martial arts especially. So there's always been a tie going all the way back to China, about 1,700 years ago. And the Okinawan diet, there is a book actually called The Okinawan Diet, written by three doctors, two brothers whose last name is Wilcox, and one Asian gentleman whose name is Suzuki. It's a 25-year study of health and wellness. You have this perfectly situated island, Okinawa, in the tropics, surrounded by wonderful water, fresh green fruits. The island is pretty much made up of coral and calcium, so you're breathing good elements right there. Low-stress lifestyle, and, of course, the exercise component, although karate is much more than exercise for the serious Okinawan, that component, those are the things together that create a long life, and the Okinawans really make a big deal of that on the island.
Okay. Sheon Isaac?
Well, I'm living proof of all the things that Mr. Hayes talked about. For example, I have a serious exposure to Agent Orange when I was in Vietnam, so I have chronic lymphoma leukemia. I have a double hip replacement, both left and right hips. I've had prostate cancer surgery, and the list goes on. And what has kept me alive with great vigor is, one, the vitamin supplements that I take, the steamed vegetables that I eat every day. I have a favorite place in Jacksonville that I like to go eat called the Yakitori House. And when I walk in, they already know my lunch menu, which is a bento box. It's steamed salmon, steamed vegetables, a small order of pickled ginger, and water and tea. And that's my lunch. If it's a cold day, I'll have what is referred to as Okinawa soba. It's Americans would view it as a soup and noodles, but it's much more than that. And so with all the traumatic things that have happened to me, and most people don't know these things have occurred, except if they read the book, of course, all these things that have occurred in my life, it is the karate, it is the Okinawan udandi that has kept me alive all these many years. And so what I am is a validation, and there's many other people out there like myself, but what I am is a validation of all the things that Mr. Hayes has just mentioned.
Well, let's move on now. Let's talk about, you know, the martial arts as a whole. You know, like I said, we have so many things going on. You know, as with the radio show, we're promoting the sport of karate. We're promoting the tradition of the martial arts. So tonight is really about the tradition of the martial arts and the effect of it. Now, Mr. Isaac, I know that, you know, your weapon study and, you know, your tuite and other techniques that you do. Let's talk about the martial arts and the weaponry, and how did you, which I know in the Okinawan training that weapons are a part of it, but I know watching you, even as I was a brown belt, and you guys were just coming back, you and Mr. Coffin, and you guys, you know, swinging the bow, the oar, the side, the comma, and, you know, in the, and this was it back in the, you know, 70s, and you guys were really, and nobody had ever seen anything like you guys were doing, and everyone stood with their mouth open and watching you guys. So tell us a little bit about the culture behind the weapons training.
Well, first of all, every weapon has a meaning behind it. And in Okinawa, the kobudo, the weapons way, is not a product as is seen in America. In America, well, let me stay on point here. I'll just stay with the Okinawans. All the tools are instruments of a trade. For example, the yakubo or the oar is still used today by the fishermen. The munji sai, the nunte bow, all the weapons have a purpose in the society of Okinawa and the outer islands as well. And so when I started training, I wanted to do two things. One, I wanted to understand the art. I wanted to go beyond just a kick, punch, and a block. And so when I was in Shimabuka Sensei's dojo, a lot of times I had private classes with him, just one-on-one, which was perhaps the greatest moments in my life. And I learned so much just by being repetitive with everything that I was doing. When I met Oto Sensei, he was a weapon student of the Matsuyoshi Kobudo, and his first instructor was Kakazu. And when I looked at the array of weapons, I mean, there's certain weapons that was never taught because there wasn't a mastery of all the basic weapons. For example, the bow, rokushaku bow, tongfa, kama, ekubo, nunte bow, Nunchaku, Sai. Those weapons weren't mastered yet. So moving on to Tempe or Rushin or three-sectional staff or Naginata or any of the other weapons, they were still out there yet because with Master Oda, he wanted perfection. He wanted you to do this until you have this and then move on. Hence, when I came back to the States and I started training and I saw what was going on in the tournament circuit, I said, well, I really can do this. I can go out here and do this. And when I went out and started competing, I was, at first, I was disappointed because I saw no base, no foundation. You know, the five elements of movement, height, distance, angle, timing, stance, I didn't see that. I saw people doing things, and again, I think sport karate is a great thing, but when you're saying you're doing a traditional weapon and you're stumbling and you're rolling and you're trying to cover it up by doing another move, you still made a mistake there. And so when I was competing, I always tried to focus on the basics, the basics, the basics. And the more I focused on the basics, the stronger I got. Plus, you know, I would call my mentor on the other end, Mr. Hayes, periodically to ask questions about my body movement, because body movement and control of what you're doing with the weapon is very important. Although it's just another extension of the kata that you're doing, you still have to keep yourself focused on the basics. And I mean, I won a bunch of tournaments, a bunch of trophies, but the whole time I was always focused on my classical and traditional element, putting that out there so that the world would see. My other counterpart was, of course, Mr. Vic Coffin, who we were like arch enemies, but it's like steel sharpening steel to become more crisp, more firm, more focused, and sharper. And, of course, now, you know, we're very good friends. But back then, we were competitive, and we made each other better. And hence, that's how our weapons became as they are. There were times when we would just take six or seven weapons, and we'd go up to the judges, and we lay them out on the floor and say, pick a weapon. And they'd look at us like we got five or six heads. I'm like, just pick a weapon. We need a weapon, and we'll do it. And so years went by, and that element of having them choose a weapon kind of like disappeared because all they wanted us to do is come up and do a bow, come up and do a sai. Well, there's other weapons. And then when I started doing Ekubo, the whole world was like, wow, that is so cool. So now everybody's doing Ekubo. And then we started doing Yari, or spear form, or Hoku, as a lot of people would call it. That's cool. You know, but those are weapons that are part of the culture. Those are weapons that are used by the fishermen, by the village, the Mura. And so here we are on the radio talking about it, and I thank you for that.
Us. And, you know, I was on YouTube, and I came across a YouTube video of Mr. Hayes doing a sai form, and you know, his hands were moving so fast, you go, oh, my God. And when he finishes, everybody was standing up applauding him. And it didn't look like it was in competition. It looked more like it was a demonstration of the weapon. So, Mr. Hayes, give us some insight on your training, your study, and your weapon philosophy.
Sure. And let me jump back to the traditional side and historical side for the weapons. In 1609, the Satsuma clan from southern Japan, Kagoshima, they were permitted by the shogun, the military ruler of Japan, to invade Okinawa, which they did, and it was a brutal, oppressive occupation of the island. And most of the weapons that folks did own at the time were not allowed, were taken away from them. So they turned to their Okinawa is a rural society. Most folks back then lived on small farms and in villages. Okinawa at that time was actually broken into three separate kingdoms, Nanzan, Chuzan, and Hokusan. Hokusan was north, Chuzan was in the middle, Nanzan was in the south. At any rate, those who were martial artists turned to the tools of the day. Again, the bow, for instance, was most often flung or slung across your shoulders with a basket on each end, carrying rice, vegetables, eggs, maybe chickens. Your kama, your sickle, was used to harvest pineapples, sugar cane, the eku, as Mr. Isaac mentioned, that was used. That's a boat oar. And even today, there are what they call haryusen, or dragon races, that take place. But that's how folks rode from village to village. When the roads were out, they would actually row their boats from shore to shore, from village to village. But each weapon did have a specific purpose. And the good thing, like the tunfa, was used to help grind grain. And even the nunchakus, which is a very much misunderstood weapon today, nun stands for horse, chaku stands for bridle. It was a horse bridle. And the shape of the original nunchaku is much different from what we see today used in demonstrations and competition. And the Okinawans, of course, used these instruments every day. It wasn't a matter of just going to the dojo for an hour or two or three on a particular evening and training, but they used them in their daily life. So they were very used to these weapons. They had a feel for them, the weight of the weapon. They were very familiar with them. And so when they actually began to use kata, to create kata with them for use, for training purposes and like protection purposes, it was a rather easy jump for them. The Kobudo in America that I brought back, the little bit that I brought back, we don't have as extensive a weapons program as Mr. Isaac's Okinawa Kempo system. But my teacher, Ezo Shimabukuro, was and is a farmer. And so my introduction to weaponry was actually helping him out on the farm. And if you can imagine, I was a New York boy. I grew up in New York, and here I am on a pig farm in northern Okinawa trying to figure out how I'm going to help him at all. And that's another story in and of itself. But it was also one of what I would call an equalizer and a compensator and a leveraging set of tools. The Okinawans are relatively small. They're stockier than the average Japanese. Mm-hmm. But they're still somewhat small. My teacher is 5'2", and most of the Marines who came and trained with him, you know, were over 6 feet, were over 200 pounds, just the nature of the beast. And I was always struck by his ability to not just generate power, but to transmit power. And he could do that either with his hands and feet, but most especially with weapons, because he had such an intimate knowledge of body dynamics, kinesiology. And so when he showed us kata, it was not just a pattern. It was a series of principles. How do you join the body? How do you align the body properly so that you can actually get the killing power? Because in my sensei's time, in his younger years, these things were used for true life protection purposes. There were no tournaments in my teacher's early days. So village life meant that everyone had a function. The women took care of the fire. There were those who went to get the water, those who milked the goats, those who took care of the meats and vegetables. So if you took anyone out of that structure, either they were kidnapped, held for ransom, or were injured somehow because of some thugs, and there were a few thugs on Okinawa, you had three generations usually at risk within a particular village. So those who mastered both the hand, the te, or the T, and the Kobudo were valued members of the society. And I always joke that, you know, here in America, we've had a spate of police shootings. And what normally happens, regardless of the circumstances, the police officer normally has to give up his or her badge and gun for a while, undergo investigation, and in some instances they're asked to go see the psychologist Monday morning. On Okinawa, if you had to take someone out, and I use that term in its strongest sense, the village gave you a party. You had protected three generations, and much of that was done with Kobudo, using the Kobudo weapons, because they would leverage the force that you could generate and transmit. And so I was introduced to it that way, in the sense that it was these were lethal tools, and Marines are just trained to understand that, since we learned about marksmanship and hand-to-hand combat, not quite as complex as what we see on Okinawa, but we were easily able to accept what the purpose, the true purpose of the weapons were. They were never to do the flash and dash. They always had a lethal purpose, but tied to protection of society, protection of others.
Well, that's a really important factor when we look at the martial arts. We look at the sports side, which is an excellent way for you to get out and develop confidence by matching your skills. But then you have this self-protection, and so many times there's so much focus on the sport of karate that we forget to teach our students how to fight. Because in a real fight, with an experienced martial artist, it's not about just punching, striking, and kicking. It's also about where and how we're using these techniques, from body pressure points, meridian lines, wrist locking techniques, you know. And I know that, you know, Shion Isaac, you know, you have a array of study in that. Let's talk about now combative training that goes beyond just the punch and kick.
Yeah. Well, are you going to do this one, Bill?
Go ahead, Sensei. I'll follow.
Okay.
Up.
All right. Okay. Let me back up to when we first went to Vietnam. When we went to, when we were in country, we got a little bit of skim training, what I call a little this and a little that. So we got traumatized seriously when we got in country. Some of us who lived in not so nice places like New York, Harlem, Watts, California, South Side of Chicago, it was like, okay, this is going to be fun. Now, we've been here before. We can do this. Today, there's all kind of computer-generated things. So what happens in our society is that the young kids, they play these video games, and they get this false sense of, hey, I can do that. So they'll go out there and they'll try to do all these wonderful things, and they'll find out that that's not how it works. When you talk about combatives, you have to talk about a mindset. And in a mindset, I use the 3-second rule. Do I want to be here? I'm here, I've got to do what I have to do, which is use the art that I've learned, use my protective art. If I've got to think about what I'm going to do, think about the technique, I'm done. I'm going to get injured, maybe lose my life. When you train in the martial arts, when you train in true protective life or life protection art, everything becomes a part of you. Things no longer become a reaction. Things become more of a action. See, you're walking down the street and somebody say, boo, you react to it, you jump maybe. But those who have trained, when you say boo, they look at you and they respond to hitting this particular point using this particular technique, using a word that I like to use a lot called intent. What is my intent? And most individuals really don't understand that word. When there's an intimate threat of danger with regards to life protection art, the other person will cease to exist because there is an intimate threat of danger. One of the things that a lot of martial art that I have seen over the years have failed to realize is that whenever a person has a weapon in their hand, that person has an advantage. Regardless of how great you are, how good you are, how fast you are, if the other person, for example, has an edge weapon, a knife, a razor blade, you're going to get cut. The question is, where are you going to allow yourself to be cut at? And yes, you might have super feet and be able to get this person, but a lot of people who train in the streets will take that shot just so they can hit that vital area with an edge weapon or a blunt force instrument and create damage to you. In life protection art, that's not what you want. What you want to do is inflict on them. Now, what I've done over the years is I've become more reserved and resilient in things that I do. I don't put myself in those situations. I don't allow myself to become braggadocious. I believe in humility because that's the way I was brought up in the martial arts. A combative situation, you don't know what's going to happen. All you can do is expect the unexpected. And our society has not got to that point yet, except those who are in the true spirit and essence of the life protection art.
You want me to jump in here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Normally at our seminars, and this is based on my training on Okinawa, and especially lots of time spent with my sensei, we ask two questions. What's the worst thing about kata? Because most of us are stuck in there. And, of course, the worst thing is that you always win, something that never happens in reality. So we try to break the mindset of always winning. Even if you just learned the kata and it's the worst-looking thing that your sensei has ever seen, the fact that you're still standing at the end means that you won, that all of your blocks worked, all of your kicks and punches landed. The second major question we ask as folks move away from the science, the kinesiology, the mechanics of kata, we ask, what was kata before it was kata? Well, it was combatives. It was true life protection fighting, and some of those techniques were strung together and stylized and standardized and squared off, so to speak, that you do on the left what you do on the right, which is not the way anyone would fight. But the structure of the kata is such that that's how we wind up doing it. But by asking the question, what was kata before it was kata, it brings us back to the original purpose, the original meaning, and we are able to find some of the techniques, especially when you mentioned earlier about wrist locks, tuite, vital point strikes, kyusho, and then the kinetics themselves, the light striking, which is called a temi, and the heavy striking, which is called todome. My teacher, what he saw was a separation between science and art. We call ourselves martial artists the day we walk in the dojo, but we're really martial scientists. We're studying weight distribution, how to create torque, power. And there's a reason for that. And through the structure of the kata, we're given something called bunkai in analysis, which it doesn't take too long for folks to see that most of that analysis is unrealistic and that it is designed to strengthen the body, which is necessary. So we keep – what I had to do on Okinawa was I got a chance to watch my teacher train as opposed to how he taught. And his training for himself was different than the way he taught. One, because he was, again, smaller than everyone in the dojo. And keep in mind that our dojos, that's the dojo that Joe Louis came out of. We had some fair shooters in the dojo. But I spent a lot of time with my teacher asking, why was he doing something different? And then he would open these small doors, and he would talk about what we call the continuum, which, again, is the striking, the vital point hits, and wrist locks, that each one of those created an opportunity for a true combative situation, always based on strong conditioning. Just like in the Marine Corps martial arts program, one of the things that we want to do is raise your conditioning, but tie it to your actual use of combative. So rather than just doing pull-ups and push-ups these days, we have a combat conditioning course that we use, program, that is designed to develop the very ability to strike, grapple, and perform joint manipulations, just as we would in old Okinawan karate. So, and keep in mind that this type of training is pretty rigid and rugged, but the Okinawan diet provided the fuel, the energy, the replenishment that you need in order to sustain that kind of training, to do away with the bone bruises and all the aches and pains that come with that. And because there were no tournaments, you could focus solely on that. And the mindset was easy to set when you looked around and you were looking at your mother, your younger sister, your grandmother who was living in another hut. Those were the folks that you were going to be fighting for. So it made it easy. And so the training was harsh on Okinawa. For my teacher's generation, and I'm one of his first-generation students, and he made it rigorous for us as well. And I've seen this now in a couple of programs. I've mentioned the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program. And just one point, now I'll move away. During tournaments, we normally get to sit up in the stands, and we watch the competition before our name is called to go down, or we're sitting on the side of the ring waiting to go. We're just sitting there putting on our protective gear. Well, of course, that's not how it goes either in Vietnam or on Okinawa in the old days. So what we do is we'll run folks through the woods until they're absolutely on the verge of exhaustion. That's when they get attacked. Then they have to call in those skills that Mr. Isaac was talking about. We call it intuitive competence. Once you've moved from the science stage to the art stage, where the principles appear almost automatically, you pick up cues. You don't wait for the punch to get there like we would in Bunkai. But you pick up the preceding movement, the shift in weight. You notice the physiological changes in the opponent. His face is flush. He's cursing at you. He's breathing hard. That tells you where to move, when to hit, what your timing will be. So, and none of that, by the way, is done in kata, because when we do competition kata, and this is just an observation, not a criticism of competition kata, we just don't have to do any of that to impress the judges. There's another set of standards, and that's probably as it should be. So, yeah, it's a bit of a different world, and I got a glimpse of it on Okinawa. And, again, I constantly thank 92-year-old Sensei for just letting me peek behind the curtain for a half a second.
Let's move on now to sort of talk about this thing that you just mentioned, is the respect for your teacher. You know, we have been working to promote and hopefully say it enough that everyone will begin to tag on, if not this year, hopefully next year, that the March Arts History Month that we're trying to do to recognize a study that a teacher will sit down and share a story with their students, or will share a story about their teacher. And I really think it's very important that you go back and find out, where did I come from? You know, if you are you have a family and you have a family name, you want to know, where did I come from? Who is my father? Where did I get started? So history is very important. You know, we have Ancestry.com that, you know, your DNA. So this is sort of what we're sort of talking about for today's martial artist, your DNA, because your DNA makeup, it's what makes you who you are at that next level. as you said before, you know, Joe Louis, you know, coming up with O Sensei, which was a mixture of American karate and traditional karate that, you know, it goes back into, you know, Joe Louis, who trained at our dojo, Bill Wallace, who came and we learned so much from him, and, you know, and those lists goes on. So your DNA can be introduced from a whole lot of information because every day that we're learning. So every time you punch, you learn to punch better. If that's your focus, and I find that so many people quit the martial arts is because they don't have the expectation of their technique getting better, and they don't have that excitement, is because many times, you know, the instructor, which is his responsibility, the martial arts, all the styles and all the systems, all the knowledge is in a written format that's taught to the instructor. Then it becomes a part of the instructor, who becomes a representation of the art and their representation of how they present this information to their students, and their expectation of the technique is how it actually moves on. So let's talk a little bit just about that, about the importance that you feel of where you guys are and the thoughts of about passing on the information to your students and how important. I know, you know, Mr. Isaac, Sean Isaac, you know, your organization has grown. You've got people all over the country that are now, you know, taking on your training to open up martial arts schools, so that legacy still moves on. So let's talk a little bit about the connection of the importance of sharing the information with your students about, you know, their lineage in the martial arts.
Well, in 1974, oh, I'm sorry. Did you want me to go ahead and start?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. In 1974, I started doing a lineage chart, and I had talked to O-Sensei, and, you know, Shimabuka-Sensei and I would have lunch. I would train. And I would train to the point of exhaustion, and just before I'd pass out, he would come on the floor and stop me and have me do a technique, and he would work on the technique, work on my hands. And so what I'm leading up to is I started asking him small questions, maybe one thing or maybe two things, and then I would jot it down. And I remember one day, and I mentioned this in the book, we were sitting down, and the floor was like big mud puddles from the sweat I had laid on the floor. And I was sitting there with him, and he was talking about each one of the instructors, Motobu, Miyagi, Kion Sensei, which was a very emotional picture whenever he looked at it and started talking about it. And I would jot these down, and I would ask questions. And then over the years, whenever I met an instructor, whether he was an American instructor or an Okinawan instructor, I would get information. I would ask little questions. And just like the Bible, you know, the Bible says the same thing, but it says it in different ways, and you have to read it all to interpret it all. And that's what I did. One of the things about the Okinawan masters that a lot of people in America still don't understand is that they always met once a week or every other week. Usually it was once a week. I know Sensei met every Thursday at the tea house. And what they would do is they would have tea or sake and talk about the art. And they would talk about the way they did it and ask, how did your instructor teach you to do it? And who was your instructor? Instructor. And so because one of the sad things about Okinawan martial arts is most of the history is unwritten. It's just passed verbally. And that that is written has what I refer to as a agenda of the perceiver. So a lot of Americans who wrote lineages down, they wrote the lineage as they perceived it to be, not really asking the question of, what do you think this is? Or is this correct how you trained? They would ask the question, is this okay to write it like this? And consequently, with me, I can only speak for myself, when I was doing lineage charts, I must have changed the chart at least over the past 30 years, at least 50 times, because everyone would say something the same way, but say it differently, and it would go back to how I originally wrote the chart, but because over time, I was misunderstanding what was being presented to me. And then years later, I think probably in 2000, I finally had the light come on and say, wait a minute here. Everybody's telling me the same thing about the training, when they started training, who they trained with. And what I was doing was thinking that it was all wrong. And so when I did the lineage chart for the Okinawan Kempo, I said to my students, my black belts, I said, this is where we are. It's going to change because you're going to be added to this. And then your black belt is going to be added to this. So this tree has a seed that grew into a tree, but all the branches grew out on the tree. And we're all part of that branch. But as I always say, we're still part of the same family. Even with Okinawan Karate, whether it's Goju, Rechiru, or Shorin, it's all part of the same family, Todi. And so I myself always try to have time where we have black belt workouts where I can share history. And it doesn't matter if they're from the same style or not. I always invite people from other styles. In fact, Mr. Hayes has been to my facility on numerous occasions, he and Hanchi Perry and a number of others. And we talk about history. We don't talk about tournaments. We don't talk about who beats up who. We talk about history, the techniques. And that helps us to grow. It helps us to become more eclectic with regards to our art.
I'll just say a few words because I see we're running out of time. And before I forget, continued success with your book, Sensei Bowen. It looks like it's just going through the roof here. Let me just say, one of the other, we always have themes for our seminars, for our trainings. And one of the other themes that we bring up is we ask the question, what is the future of our past? And that ties to what you were saying earlier about DNA. For us, our DNA is our kapa. Even though kapa are perceived as being different mechanically and technically on Okinawa, it's the principles that make them the same. And the old Okinawans always used to say that all Okinawan karate is the same. But we explore that. And so the key is to pass on the principles kind of hidden in the mechanics of the karate. There's some folks who probably shouldn't learn too much, and they drop away over the years. Those who stay, the Okinawans, simply open up the kapa a little bit more as you would look inside of a vessel to see what's in it, what it actually contains. And that's the essence of our art. It's tied to combatives. It's tied to life detection. It's tied to culture. It's tied to the diet of Okinawa and the lifestyle, and even the music, which sets the rhythm for our kapa. I know we're running out of time, so I'll just leave it there.
Well, guys, I really do appreciate you guys coming on to our show. Like I said, Professor Gary Lee, we have taken on, he's with the Sport Karate Museum, so we've taken on this essence of trying to ignite a surge in the old and the new, and meaning that, you know, for many martial artists that we featured this year in the Who's Who in the martial arts autobiography book, they told about their adventures, you know, their lives. And the emphasis was, why did you get started? Because I feel that if we want to change society, we really have to provide more models for our youth to be able to see. I know for myself, my first experience when I joined the school, I wanted to not be beaten up by a guy on my job. And the Enter the Dragon that just came out, and I saw what Bruce Lee did to those guys, and that was my image that would be happened to me if I came up against this guy that was a martial artist. You know, he was going to be slinging me all over the place. It wasn't pretty. So out of fear, I started searching for a martial arts school, and, you know, fortunately, Karate International was the only school that actually answered the telephone. Because if another dojo had answered the telephone, my life story would be totally different. And that's giving, you know, thanks and praises, you know, back to my teacher. You know, but as we go back, my really first model that I first saw that about martial arts and my love for sport karate was Chuck Norris. I was picked up a magazine. I'd never seen a magazine before, and he's hemming, has his foot up in a chair, and a little old lady is hemming his uniform. He's got this great, huge trophy sitting on his thigh. I knew at that moment I wanted to be a martial arts champion. I didn't know anything else about the martial arts, but I knew Chuck Norris was my model. And so what we're saying today is that we're hoping that someone will pick up, you know, our book, will pick up your book, and will begin to read and not be able to put it down because of the information and motivation. You know, I'm very grateful, you guys, when we wrote the book last year to pay honor to, you know, Sensei Wellendorf and to Dale Brooks, you know, for their writing of Who's Who in American Karate. You know, it was about one thing. We only had 75 masters and grandmasters that we featured in the book, and you guys were a part of that, and you were part of the foundation of starting the AMAA, the American Martial Arts Alliance Hall of Fame, and the other things that we did, you know, some years ago. You know, but that was the key element that we want to bring forth. And I think, you know, Mr. Hayes, your book, you know, someone picking it up and understanding your relationship to your training, to your teacher, and the same thing, you know, Mr. Isaac, same thing. Someone's picking up to know about you, or someone's picking up, you know, the Who's Who in the martial arts to understand, which has over 250 martial artists telling their slight story about why they got started. And if we can build a platform around the why, and because we already know if you study martial arts and you study under a good teacher, your life is going to change. And I use that word good teacher because the person that trains you is going to influence you in his perception of success, in his perception of technique. You know, so that the martial arts instructor is very critical. But this is why with the show we want to talk to other martial artists to, you know, to get your insight. You know, we have a great group of people that we have lined up, you know, to be coming on the show. And we want to make sure it's totally diversified when people come on. So it's not just all about sport karate, which we love and we're really promoting. But you got to have understand where did you come from to understand where you're going. So understanding the tradition behind the martial arts and having that, finding out, getting your teacher to share his story. You have to share these stories with your students so that their foundation in the martial arts is not weak. Because if they only have the kick and punch, their foundation is going to be weak. They need to learn about, you know, the great martial artists, you know, Grandmaster Jun Ri, the other martial artists that have made the American way. But before we got to America, we came from someplace else, and forced to understand that we haven't been here with this knowledge for, especially here in the U.S. You know, we haven't had this knowledge, you know, along thousands of years. This is still new. We're still evolving. We're still learning. We're trying to preserve the history so that we matter. And I think our theme is this year has been standing on the shoulders of greatness of those martial artists, your teachers, and which has allowed you guys to, you know, come back from your journey from Okinawa to the U.S. and then, you know, lay that foundation. As I said before, especially with Mr. Isaac, you know, I've learned so much, you know, from you, you know, as a student, you know, as a mentor, you know, you have, you know, you've changed my life, and you've always guided me in a direction that made me better as I have now grown to a master instructor. And I know you're going to be here this weekend, and I'm going to be, you know, putting on my white belt, getting my my Echo Bow out, and I'm going to be learning more, you know, from you. But this is what we do. It's not about that belt that's tied around our waist. It's really about our openness to learn, because you never master anything, because there's a whole nother level that makes you grow. And this is what we really have to do. So, everyone, this is what we want you to take from not only this show, but the other shows that we are producing, the other masters we're introducing to you. So, guys, let's share. How do we get your book? I know, Mr. Hayes, your book is, I saw that you're rewriting the book. Now, I tell you what, that's what I was going to say to you. You know, I saw online, and I truly hope it's true. I went to Amazon, and I was looking for your book, and I saw a copy of your book on sale for $2,000. And I hope it's true, because I have – I'm not going to sell my copy, though. I'm going, $2,000? No, I'm good for $17. I'm good for $17.
We have seen some outrageous prices. Folks were buying 40 and 50 copies at a time. We've gone through, we're pretty much finished with the seventh printing. We've sold out six complete printings, and we're pretty much sold out of the seventh printing. And I was hoping I could turn to my second book, which will pick up starting with my second tour, and can now get a little more in-depth. So, and again, all of that is a surprise to me. I thought I might be able to coerce one of my cousins or nephews into buying a copy of the book when it first came out. But it has done well, and that's a blessing. I am working on a second book slowly, although my attorney keeps telling me I can't put this in. This is too dangerous. You're going to get sued if you tell somebody to do this, that, and the other. So we're thinking our way through the second book. The best way for folks, if they would like a copy, is either to email me at oldstudent1, the numeral 1, at cox.net, cox.net. We've been doing the fulfillment ourselves, some of my students and I. We tried the Barnes & Noble thing. That just didn't work out, quite frankly. We shipped off a bunch of books to them some years back and never heard from them. So maybe the books got lost. I don't know. But by coming directly to us, I can figure out who I should sign the book to, if there's some special dedication. oldstudent1@cox.net would be the best way to get a copy of My Journey with the Grandmaster.
Okay, Mr. Isaac, how can folks get a copy of your book?
Well, there's a couple of ways. The easiest way is to go to Amazon and look up Wherever the Path Leads. Once again, it's Wherever the Path Leads. It's on Amazon. It's $19.99. Or I have a special edition book that has come out that's only been out a week now, and it can only be gotten through me. It's my original work, and it's called The Journey Never Ends. It's similar to Wherever the Path Leads. It's just my original writing, and that's only gotten through me. So if you want to email me at lisaac@ec.rr.com. I will be happy to respond and autograph copy of the book. It's $19.99 plus $5 shipping and handling. And I'll be happy to autograph them and get them out. And I will bring some books Saturday for you, Mr. Bowen.
Yes, sir. That'll be awesome. That'll be awesome, sir. Now, I've already got my personal copy, and I do appreciate that, sir. And, the guys, remember, you can always get a copy of the new 2016 Who's Who in the Martial Arts. Again, the book is 336 pages, and it features over 250 martial artists sharing their story. It has photographs from the AMAA Who's Who Legends Awards Banquet, that amazing weekend. Cynthia Rothrock is on the front cover. And we also have the 2015 book, which is the first book. And in that book, you will find Mr. Hayes and Mr. Isaacs, who are board members for the AMAA. And we're trying to, you know, really working hard to really try to do a great job to share our knowledge, to working on any way we can do to preserving the integrity of the martial arts. And I would recommend anyone, you know, like I said, I'm having a training seminar here with Mr. Isaac on Saturday. We got 4 hours of training. 2 hours is going to be on the bow. 2 hours is going to be on the comma. And so constantly learning. Mr. Hayes, I'm hoping that we can get on your schedule again. It's been a couple of years since you've been to North Carolina to, you know, share your wisdom and knowledge. So I'm hoping that I can catch you early and get on a schedule to have you in here in North Carolina. And everyone, this year, you can tell this has been a great show, a lot of great information. The guys have left their information. You can contact them, you know, for questions. If you have questions about your system and styles, and you connect, your teacher connects back to the Okinawan martial arts system, these guys would be more than happy to, you know, share with you their information to help you make a connection to who you are. Everyone, I'd like to say, you know, thank you for listening in, and to my guests, really want to thank you guys for being a part of this program.
Well, thank you, Sensei.
All right.
And thank you, Mr. Isaac.
Bill San.
All right, everybody.
Mata Astane.
Okay.
Bill San. Mata Astane.
Hi. Thank you.